Hello, and welcome to another edition of Interviewing the Legends, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency, devoted to promoting musicians and authors worldwide. Call us today at 941-877-1552 to start your free publicity evaluation. Remember, we shine only when we make you shine. Please welcome the host of Interviewing the Legends, music journalist, author, and entrepreneur, Ray Shasho.
Hello, once again, everyone. I'm your host, Ray Shasho. Welcome to another edition of Interviewing the Legends on BBS Radio, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Call us today at 941-877-1552 or email us at publicityworksagency.com. Remember, we shine only when we make you shine. Don Daneman and Mike Loskamp, two original members of the 60s pop music group The Circle, best known for the hits Red Rubber Ball and Turn Down Day, have reunited, added a few members, and reinvented themselves around the 50th anniversary of the band's success. Named The Circle by John Lennon himself and managed by none other than Brian Epstein, they were the Beatles' opening act on 18 tour dates, including August 23rd, 1966 at Shea Stadium, and August 29th, 1966, for the Beatles' famous final concert at Candlestick Park. 1966, the band released two Billboard hit songs, Red Rubber Ball, and went gold, selling over 1 million copies. The following follow-up single, Turn Down Day, was a solid hit as well, becoming their second top 20 song of the year. Coupling extraordinary musical talent and classic hit songs, The Circle promises to electrify fans today, just as they did when they were the opening act for the Beatles. Please welcome original lead singer, songwriter, guitarist, and founding member of 60s legends, The Circle, Don Daneman, to Interviewing the Legends. Hello, Don.
Hey, Ray. I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing good under the circumstances. How is your family doing under the...
Well, we're quarantined like everyone else, and my wife and I actually do pretty well on this because we make no bones about it. We are TV binge watchers. And funnily enough, a lot of our binge watching is Asian, Korean dramas.
Really?
Yeah, and we're reading subtitles, and we found it really interesting. It takes you out of your regular realm of.
Right.
You know, it just brings you to another era. You know, especially the historical ones. It's kind of funny.
Yeah, we're binge watchers too. You know, we have Roku, so we have all the stations there, the Netflix and HBO and all that stuff.
Yeah.
So we do the same thing. You know, we watch a lot of medical stuff because my wife is a retired nurse.
So. Well, okay, that makes sense.
I saw on YouTube your coronavirus parody song.
Yes, you know, we were talking. You know, I don't live where the rest of the group lives, but we're communicating all the time. We're right. back and forth all the time, and they were saying, "Hey, why don't you? You know, you should. You know, get on, make a video, do something. You know, just to acknowledge the. You know, we're not playing, but we really want to play." And I thought it might be fun to just come up with a little, you know, Corona lyric to Red Rubber Ball.
Sure.
Just, you know, do a phone video and sing it live. And my understanding is that it's gotten like thousands of views. So it was kind of cool to do that.
You know, you have a lot of concert dates coming up. So hopefully I'll keep my fingers crossed for you because there's been a lot of cancellations.
I'm going to correct you. We have a lot of concert dates not coming up.
Oh, really? Are they all canceled already?
The way this looks, you know.
Yeah, I know you got some scheduled from, let's see, in June. You got up to November is what I saw.
Yeah, there definitely are dates scattered
right
throughout the rest of this year. And there were ones that have officially been canceled.
Right.
But others that have not yet, and I'm interested to see how this develops. You know, like, do we end up playing at all this year?
Yeah, this,
I don't know, you know?
This affected a lot of musicians, man.
Yeah. But I'm having, you know, I am having an interesting time, you know, that I have actually some projects that I did that I get a real kick out of. I have my own, I have a basement recording studio.
Okay.
And many of your fans may know, excuse me, that I got friendly with 60s on 6 DJ Flash Phelps.
Okay.
And I did a theme song for him.
Mm-hmm.
that he plays pretty regularly on his show, and it was his birthday, actually this past Saturday was his birthday,
right.
And I thought, what would be an interesting thing to do, especially being home quarantined now, and I thought, I rewrote the theme song and put birthday lyrics on it.
Huh.
So that was a fun thing to do, and then he has this thing he does where he does the city of the day.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he has people guess. Okay, he gives them clues, and he has people guess, like, what city am I talking about? And I did a little theme song for that. So that's been kind of fun. I have another project that one of the promoters that hires us pretty regularly, and we've gotten to be real good friends with, he has a relationship with a young singer who basically, it's funny, because this guy, I think he's maybe 21 or something like that, and he loves doo-wop.
Mm-hmm.
And he's been on some of the PBS specials featuring all these artists, obviously as a young guy, sort of helping out. And he wanted me to do a duet with him on, like, one of the old doo-wop duet songs. And we're tentatively going to do a video duet on the song, What's Your Name? Mm-hmm. Is it Mary or Sue? You know, if some of your listeners remember that from, like, late 50s doo-wop. So I definitely do stuff. It's fun. I have a good time with my, you know, just coming down to the studio. And between that and binge-watching and an occasional driveway with proper distancing, we occasionally do driveway get-togethers with our neighbors.
Oh, cool.
You know, we bring out chairs, sit at the back of our driveway.
Yeah.
And they're on their driveway, and the other one is in the middle of the cul-de-sac, and we, you know, we bring our own stuff, and we have little get-togethers. So
that's
what we're doing right now.
Yeah. Where are you located at?
We're in Delaware.
Oh, Delaware. Okay. Yeah. I'm originally from the from Maryland, so I used to go to Rehoboth Beach all the time.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah, Delaware's a cool place. What I was going to say here is, you know, I always thought, and not only me, but a lot of other people that followed the circle in the '60s, a lot of people thought you were a British man.
Well, the obvious connection is that we were managed by Beatle manager Brian Epstein.
Right, which
but
is
basically
unusual.
The circle started out as the Rondells,
right.
Rhondells, at Lafayette College, and we became a really good fraternity band. You know, if you wanted a good band for your fraternity parties, that was us.
Sure.
We did, you know, we did Beatles, we did Beach Boys, Four Seasons, mm-hmm. all and oldies, you know, all, well, what was not so old then, current stuff of the day, including a lot of oldies, you know, late 50s stuff, late
right.
50s, early 60s, and so between 61 and 65, we were the fraternity, we were a good fraternity band, and the connection to Brian Epstein came about when, at the end of what would have been the Rondells' career as a college fraternity band, we were playing in Atlantic City
mm-hmm.
for the summer. This would be the summer of 1965.
Right.
End of summer, all going to go our separate ways. And in walks a gentleman named Nat Weiss to the Alibi Bar, mm-hmm. where we were playing, mm-hmm. and he hears us and he introduces himself. Hey, you know, I'm down here on a fraternity convention. I'm a lawyer. I'm actually a matrimonial lawyer from New York, and I'm good friends with Beatle manager Brian Epstein, and we're about to form a management company here in New York. And I think you guys are really good. Why don't you get in touch with me? So we thought, baloney.
Yeah.
You know, people don't come in and, you know, know that. And we had been given, you know, stories like that before that
sure.
turned out to be nothing.
Right.
So, anyway, excuse me, sorry. I was now end of summer. I was back home in East Chester, New York, working for my dad in a small sheet metal manufacturing company mm-hmm. that he was a partner in.
Right.
And I was waiting to get into the Coast Guard Reserve.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, you know, why don't I give this guy a call? Maybe he's for real. I have his card. So one day I call him. And, you know, he answers, and he remembers me. Oh, Don, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, you guys were great. Why don't you come down to New York? He gave me the date. It was like a few days later.
Right.
Come down. Here's the address. I'll introduce you to Brian. Really? Okay.
I'll play along.
So, anyway, I took a buddy of mine. I went down. We went down. And it was a one of those small buildings on Side Street on the Upper East Side
uh-huh.
in Manhattan. And
right.
we go, you know, we walk. It was a one flight up party. We're standing around. Nat's not there. Finally, Nat walks in. I go up to him, and I, you know, well, Nat, here I am. Yeah, come on, Don, follow me downstairs. I follow him down the stairs, walk out, and there's a limo on the street.
Uh-huh.
And I want you to picture a very dramatic person who, he takes his hand, he flings it kind of across himself, and he beckons me into the limo.
Okay.
Like, he opens the door, and he beckons me into the limousine.
Right.
I follow him in. He sits me down, and there I am sitting directly across from Brian Epstein.
Wow, that's incredible.
And now I know what Brian Epstein looks like, so this is no baloney now. This is for real.
Yeah.
And now he introduces me, and whenever I tell this, I have to clarify. My level of musicianship is pretty good, mm-hmm. but it's not like the best musician in the world, you
right.
know. However, Nat introduces me. Brian Epstein, I'd like you to meet Don Daneman, one of the finest musicians I know. Gulp.
Nice.
Okay? So, I get to shake hands with Brian, and the conversation, it was a fairly short conversation. Now, Brian, from the very moment that I met him, is a true gentleman.
Right.
He was very gracious. Oh, Don, yes, you know, Nat has spoken very highly of you, and perhaps, you know, maybe we can get something going, so stay in touch, and we'll see. You know, I'm saying in my phony Brian Epstein accent. So, anyway, a couple of words back and forth, and then, as graciously as Matt beckoned me into the limo, he now, with the same gesture, beckoned me out. Well, Don, we have to go, and, you know, so out I go, and there I am standing on the street, and the image I have in my head of how that moment ended is picture the video camera behind me looking kind of up the street. So you see me silhouetted, you know, from the back,
mm-hmm.
and there's the limo,
yep.
and it's night, you know, so it's lit in street lights. The limo slowly pulls off into the black, and video fades out. So that was my moment of meeting Brian Epstein. Hence, you know, answering the question, why did people maybe think we were English? Anyway, what happened next is I call Tom and Marty. Tom, he was bass guitar singer, and Marty was our drummer.
Mm-hmm.
Our keyboard player, Earl Pickens,
mm-hmm.
The original keyboard player,
right.
He was off in medical school. Tom and Marty were still at Lafayette. go out and play occasional weekends still.
Yep.
Anyway, I called them, and this was very exciting now. So what we did is, the three of us, we set up a makeshift recording studio using our own. We each had a couple of, had a tape recorder and our band equipment. We set up a makeshift recording studio in my basement in Eastchester, and we recorded several demos, and they actually turned out pretty good. I made an appointment to see Nat Weiss to play him, because we thought, let's get him excited. You know, we have this in, let's see if we can really get him excited. So I had an appointment to play these demos for Nat, and I will give you the date of the appointment, and I'll just take a second and see if you can identify the date. November 9th, 1965. Does that mean anything to you? Take a moment, and then I'll tell you what it was.
Okay. 1965, well, it's a Beatle year, definitely. Something happened with the Beatles, right?
No, nothing with the Beatles.
Nothing with the Beatles. 1965, huh?
November 9th.
November 9th, 65. No.
Okay, I'll tell you.
Okay.
November 9th, 1965 was the day of the blackout of the entire East Coast.
Oh, wow.
Or most of the East Coast, if you
yeah.
and your listeners remember that.
Okay.
And that's when we thought the Russians are invading. It was really actually kind of scary. Anyway, obviously, I didn't play it then. We made an appointment, and I played it a couple of days later. I was able to visit Nat. He had an apartment on the Upper East Side, and I brought my tape recorder. I was ready to kind of wire it into his stereo system, but I also brought a pair of stereo headphones.
Right.
And stereo headphones were comparatively new
right.
at that time.
Yep.
Anyway, I had him listen with stereo headphones. I put it on, I hit play. I said, you know, Nat, listen to these, you'll hear it a little bit better. And I knew I had him when I hit play and the music came on, and his eyes kind of went up to the ceiling. You know, it's like, you know. So he got really excited. And he began to get us a few club dates in Manhattan. Mm-hmm. Tom and Marty came in and got us some auditions for record companies, and we ended up at Columbia Records with their new young producer, John Simon.
John Simon, yeah.
Who became our producer for the early, you know, the beginning part of the Circle experience.
Sure.
And now, here we are now, we now have a Columbia record contract. We are managed by Beatle manager Brian Epstein with his partner, Nat Weiss.
Mm-hmm.
And two things now. We needed material to record, and we needed a new name, because we all agreed the Rondells was not...
Right.
It wasn't a contemporary kind of name. It was like an old 50s sort
right,
of name.
Exactly.
So, all right, so two things. The first thing is that we're now hanging around Greenwich Village.
Mm-hmm.
And bandmate Tommy Dawes became friendly with a fellow named Barry Kornfeld, who had a publishing company
mm-hmm.
with Paul Simon.
Okay.
And he heard Paul's demo of Red Rubber Ball.
Right.
Basically on a 45, just Paul and the guitar singing this song, singing
right.
Red Rubber Ball.
Uh-huh.
And when we all listened to it, I will admit to thinking it was cute, but not that big a deal. And everybody else thought, yeah, this is good. Let's record this.
Mm-hmm.
No, I was fine to record it. And now, so we're now in the process of recording Red Rubber Ball, being one of the things that we were recording at this point. And this would have been late in the year 65
right.
through very early in the year 66. So we're recording Red Rubber Ball, amongst other things, and we're still needing a new name. So here we are one day in the studio, and Brian was in town, and whenever he was in town, he made sure that we got together. He comes up to me, and he hands me his business card. Oh, Don, take a look at this. Hands me his business card. And I look at the card, and it looks cards. He said, oh, no, don't. Turn it over. Turn the card over, and there, scribbled in, you know, some scribbled writing, mm-hmm. was something that I couldn't quite read. It was like, Sir Kerr, why? I'm not, Brian, what am I reading here? Oh, Dawn, this is your new name. And as you see, it's Circle. You're going to be the Circle. CYRKLE with the funny spelling. And it was, in fact, John who came up with the name. Mm-hmm. And you can see, you know, you can just picture how John, with his clever, interesting mind, came up with Circle with the funny spelling. So here I am now with this card in my hand. And to this day, I am so angry at myself because that card went in the trash the next day.
Oh, no.
And it would have been so cool to be up on my wall.
Yeah, you know, exactly.
In the studio now with a big frame around it, important frame.
I know. That's a shame.
Anyway, so here we are. So now we had our name, and Red Rubber Ball was recorded, and in... So I forget the exact date, but the gist is somewhere in February, I now went into the Coast Guard Reserve. So Red Rubber Ball was out there,
right,
or was ready to be released.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out Red Rubber Ball got released and actually became a hit while I was in the Coast Guard Reserve.
Mm.
So I had a little bit of, you know, when you're in boot camp, you don't really have much communication with the outside world, but I was able to get an occasional phone call in. And Nat told me, Nat Weiss, he said, hey, Don, if you can get a pass, we have a chance to be on Hullabaloo.
Wow.
And introduced Red Rubber Ball.
Mm-hmm.
So, and whenever I talk about this, I must, and I always do, the Coast Guard people were wonderful. They really kind of understood. I mean, yes, I had my Coast Guard duties and I fulfilled them, but they gave me a 3-day pass to go and be on Hullabaloo, and we did Red Rubber Ball. So it's kind of cool that, here we are in, I believe it was April of 1966, we appear on Hullabaloo. With us was Paul Anka, who was the host.
Right.
Leslie Gore was on the show, and Peter and Gordon were on the show. And as many of your listeners may know, Peter Asher, Paul McCartney actually lived with Peter Asher's family for some time, and he is, you know, they were quite close. Peter Asher was a major a producer and influence on Apple Records, on the Beatles record company. And it turns out, and I only found this out recently, Peter Asher was one of Nat Weiss's best friends later in life. And I only found that out recently when we met him on the Flower Power cruise last year that we were booked on.
Yep.
So it's interesting how things kind of come together.
I've had Peter Asher on the show.
Yeah.
He's a good guy.
Yeah. Lovely guy. Lovely guy. So anyway, so here we are. So we're on Hullabaloo. Red Rubber Ball gets played. And I go back in boot camp. Now, the next big thing was, at the end of boot camp, my week was scheduled to go off on a Coast Guard cutter and basically would have been gone for a couple of months.
Right.
And once again, the Coast Guard came through for me. I begged. I said, look, I really have this opportunity. Please, can you get me back to New York? And they did. They said, you know, I ended up, they put me on a buoy tender in Staten Island. And what that, it was a very interesting dichotomy of life in that, so here I am on the buoy tender. I would, at the end of a normal day, I could get on the Staten Island ferry, go into New York, meet the guys at Columbia Studios, record all night, come back, just make it in time kind of to check in and wash, and I was a mess cook and washing pots and pans all day. It was a very interesting way of life. So the next thing, anyway, so now Red Rubber Ball actually became a hit during my stay in the Coast Guard Reserve.
Right.
So the next major thing that happened was we were asked to be on the Beatles tour,
mm-hmm.
the whole, you know, 1966 Beatles tour, the whole deal, and I was not going to be able to make it because my active duty was going to make me miss that tour. And it was a six-month active duty commitment.
Wow.
You know, after which you're in the reserve and you have, you know, like monthly meetings, that kind of thing.
Sure.
Anyway, I kid about this. The United States government decided that we don't want Don to miss the Beatles tour. And I don't know how this happened, but out of the blue, the government decided that 6 month active duty is now going to be 5.
Wow.
And I was able to get out and do the Beatles tour, which was so amazingly lucky. And so we got to do the Beatles tour. We did the whole, the whole tour, got to meet them, got to hang out. It was a great experience. And playing in for huge stadiums like that and doing pretty well. You know, when we, at the first concert, we were like, oh God, are they going to boo us off stage? We want the Beatles. What's going to happen? Well, if you think about it, we actually had 2 hit records at the time. Red Rubber Ball was up and maybe on the way down, but had peaked. You know, it was a huge hit.
Yeah.
Turn Down Day was released and up, you know, kind of slowly moving up. And, you know, when we went on in the very first show, which was Chicago at an indoor arena, we got big cheers, you know, whoops and hollers and yay, and it was great, and we played for our 20 minutes or so, and it was wonderful. It was a really fabulous feeling to have that. And then, so now we're finished playing, and we hadn't met the Beatles yet. Although we were on the same plane with them going from New York to Chicago.
Yep.
And on that plane, the Beatles, everybody, the whole tour was on the plane. You know, big commercial airliner. Mm-hmm. The Beatles were behind a wall in the back. And we keep looking back. Are they going to come out? Are they going to come out? And finally, Paul comes out. And he, you know, and we're looking, ah, there's Paul, oh my God, oh my God. And he looks like a very pleasant, jovial guy, and you can see he's shaking hands with people, like he's obviously meeting some for the first time, some he knows, and you can see he's a very sociable, good guy. And we're towards the front of the plane. He finally works his way up, and we now get to meet Paul. So, I'm sitting next to bandmate Tommy Dawes and co-manager Nat Weiss.
Mm-hmm.
And he introduces us because he knows them. So it's Don Daneman, meet Paul McCartney. Shake hands. Wow, Paul, great to meet you. We're big Beatles fans. Couple of words. Tommy Dawes, meet Paul McCartney. Same thing, you know, a couple of words. Paul says, okay, well, good to meet you guys. We'll see you around. And back he goes, disappears behind the door. And Tommy and I spent the rest of the flight analyzing every little stupid word that we said, like why couldn't we have been cooler and make them stay longer. And while we did obviously get to hang out with them later on and it was, you know, more relaxed, this was a totally failure. That's how it was for us.
You know, this reminds me of when the Beatles met Elvis.
Yeah, I could see, you know, see that. Anyway, so here we are now, back in Chicago. We had just played, and the I just want to describe what, like, a couple of things to give you a sense of what this was like. So now, this was, I believe it was a hockey, either hockey or basketball arena, you know, so it's kind of long and narrow, and the stage, the back of the stage is against the seats of one of the narrow, you know, on the narrow side there. So I was standing just behind the stage, because it's all open, just behind the stage in the stands looking down directly on the stage. Now, we did meet Paul for that quickie, but we hadn't met the whole band yet.
Right.
And finally, now, we had played, and it was a successful performance. It was great. We had played, and now the Beatles come out. So here, I'm just going to give you a couple of impressions of
sure.
that I still remember so clearly. So the first thing is the Beatles come out, and they were wearing what looked to me like very elegant, velvety sort of jackets.
Uh-huh.
And in that light, they looked dark green to me. Now, I can't tell you what the real color was, but in that light, that's what it looked like. Very elegant. Like, these are major, important people wearing these
yep.
elegant outfits. And they come on stage, they start playing. And so the first thing is that the crowd is, of course, going wild. And it's all of that noise and wild emotions that is now self-contained in an enclosed stadium. There's a roof. So the noise bounces back. It doesn't go off to the sky. And it made it really very, very intense. And just two things that I would like to describe is that, so I was standing next to a woman. I didn't know her, but I'm guessing she was maybe part of the press people that were there.
Right.
And she must have been, I'm guessing, in her mid-30s, let's say. And she was crying. I mean, tears
yeah.
were just rolling down her face
yeah.
just from the emotion of the whole thing. And the other thing that I got was you could look out to the audience, and as far as I could see, now, of course, you only get to see the first few rows
right.
usually when you're looking from
right.
backstage because of the way the lights were, but from what I could see of the audience, picture the Wizard of Oz backstage behind a curtain
mm-hmm.
with an electronic keyboard that controls, that has a little shock device set up to all the seats in the audience, and he randomly keeps pushing buttons. Bop, 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 bop. Every time he pushes a button, a shock goes out to some little girl in the audience, and she jumps up out of her seat. And so what I saw was up, besides all of the overall, yeah, individual little girls jumping, literally jumping out of their seats.
Yeah.
And it was just an amazing, amazing experience. So it was, yeah, very cool, very cool.
Where did you guys fit on the bill? I know there was Bobby Hebb, the Ronettes, the Remains. Where were you guys at?
I believe that we came before the Ronettes.
Okay.
I think. That's my recollection. And the honest truth is, I'm not 100% sure, but I think it was the Remains, Bobby Hebb,
mm-hmm.
us, the Ronettes, and the Beatles. And my sense is, they figured, let's break it up, you know, let's break up with a girl group before the Beatles. That's my sense of it. So, you know, it was, like I say, it was really great.
I want to remind the audience how huge this is. First of all, Brian Epstein managed all British acts. He did the Beatles, Jerry and the Pacemakers, Billy J. Kramer and the Dakotas, the Moody
yeah.
Blues, Celia Black, and you're the only American band, I think, that he managed. Which is,
you know, we knew that, but the importance of it actually never quite hit home to me until, and this is going back to Peter Asher now,
mm-hmm.
Last year, like I think I maybe just mentioned, we were on the Flower Power cruise.
Sure, I saw
that. Which was really cool,
that.
By the
yep.
way. You
mm-hmm.
know, if you're a 60s music fan,
oh, yeah.
and you have the ability
yep.
to do this, this was a couple of thousand passengers, all of whom paid some good bucks to hear 60s music.
Yep.
And a whole bunch of important 60s bands were on this tour. And we were one of the bands on the tour. And Mm-hmm. And he made a big point out of telling people, you know, I'm going to introduce a band now, and I just want you to think about the success of Brian Epstein and the Beatles and all the bands that he managed. This was the one American group that Brian Epstein chose to manage.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, even, you know how sometimes you know things, but they come back to you in a way that really hit you home?
Yep.
In a way that you never quite got.
Right.
And I remember saying to myself as I'm watching Peter Asher introduce us and describe us like this, and I go, oh my God, wow. That's right. So, you know, the funny thing is, you know, in life, you have various moments that really kind of hit home to you, that like make a real impression. This was one of them.
Yep.
And it only happened late in life, you know, last year is when that happened.
Here's another fact I want to let the audience know about that is huge. 1966 was a humongous year for music. I remember like it was yesterday because I was an Orioles fan. They beat the Dodgers four mm-hmm. straight. They beat Koufax.
Okay.
But the end of the year Billboard, you know, for the top 100. Now you guys, you know, you finished in the, you know, top three, and then you were right behind the Beatles, I think, number two. And but at the end of the year, all these great bands for the top 100. You guys finished at 25, and now listen to the other bands here. Number one was the Mamas and the Papas. You had the Monkees in the top five, Frank Sinatra, Paul Revere and the Raiders, the Supremes, Donovan. The Beatles had several hits that were below you guys, like Yellow Submarine. I mean, it's incredible, you know, the competition you guys had back there, and to still finish, you know, high ranking like that. That's
my understanding is that Red Rubber Ball actually was Billboard's number 20 of the year, 1966. That's where Red Rubber Ball was.
Okay, I got here 25, but it might be wrong. It's under Wikipedia, so. And that's December 24th.
That's always been my understanding that it was number 20.
But, okay.
You know, well, who cares about a few points one way
that's
or the other?
That's still incredible.
Yeah. No, it was amazing. I would like to share something else about Red Rubber Ball. I want to share a couple of specific things about Red Rubber Ball.
Mm-hmm.
I think I mentioned earlier that when we first heard it and decided to record it, I thought it was cute, and you know, okay, let's take a shot and record it. And I've always thought of Red Rubber Ball that way.
Right.
Through much of my adult life, including after the group broke up. You mm-hmm. know, like, yeah, okay, we were lucky, we had a hit record. Very cool. So, here's the first thing about Red Rubber Ball. Like, a new impression for me as a circle who obviously was there at the time. I'm the lead voice on it, you know. But a new awareness, and that is somewhere in the mid-80s, a small record company called Sundays got the license to release the Circle catalog. You know, they specialize in oldie kind of releases. And they asked me to comment mm-hmm. on it. They sent me, a cassette at the time. You know, listen to this. So, I hadn't listened to Red Rubber Ball. Basically, from the time that the group broke up, I got into doing commercials.
Sure.
You know, working, I had my own production company working for ad agencies, mm-hmm. and we did jingles and other audio work for ad agencies. And I was very involved in that. I loved it, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
So, anyway, they asked me to comment on this cassette, like, here's how we're going to release it. And it was pretty much chronological. The recordings were pretty much chronological. So Red Rubber Ball was the first recording on there. And I finally had a chance to listen to it actually on an airplane. I was by myself going somewhere. And I took out my Sony Walkman, and I put on headphones, and I, you know, crouched down, and I listened to it, and on comes Red Rubber Ball. And I had an epiphany when the first couple of notes of Red Rubber Ball came on, when I realized, oh my God, this really does sound like a hit record, and it has had a couple of things to it that immediately made it sound like a hit record for me. There's the recognized organ lick.
Yep. Da, 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 exactly. Da, da. Yeah.
Then there's the guitar lick,
right,
which I played. Da, 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 da,
You know what? You guys had a lot of other good songs. I mean,
we did. And if you listen to it, you get some, you know, good accolades from people who pick up on the later recordings. And they were good, no question about it, and liked by many people, but just not enough to make them huge hits.
Some of the
Red Rubber Ball.
Some of the songs I like. I like The Visit. She Was Here.
Great record.
That's a great tune. Weight of Your Words. That was another good song. Penny Arcade, Cloudy, which I think was a Paul Simon song.
Yes, it was a Paul Simon song.
Yeah, and how about We Had a Good Thing Going, and Please Don't Ever Leave Me, which had the harpsichord in there. You guys were great.
They were great.
Not a great song.
It just didn't quite go up to Red Rubber Ball. But yes, they were great, and thank you for the compliments. Let me share with you one other thing about Red Rubber Ball, and this one I only became aware of in the more recent years of our Circle revival.
Okay.
And I became aware of it meeting people, like when we play, we always do meet and greet after the show.
Sure.
So people come up to us and, you know, we talk, we do autographs, we talk, we take pictures. It's, you know, we're just hanging out. So, and I'll just give you a few little bits that made me realize, oh, wow. So, first one is pretty simple. You know, people will come up to me, and it's very typical, you know, that I'll get a comment. Do you know Red Rubber Ball was my first 45? live, mm-hmm. and we played it to death, and true. We just loved it. It was so great. It made us feel good. Yeah. That's the first one. Another one, and this is sort of unusual, but a fella came up to me after a concert, and he shook my hand, and he said, "Thank you." And I said, "You're welcome. Why are you thanking me?" And he says, "I just want you to know that Red Rubber Ball got me through my divorce."
Yeah.
It's just, you know, we come on every day on the radio, and, you know, it's such an uplifting, you know, it's just one of those uplifting songs, makes you feel good, and it got me through my divorce. Great. And the most poignant one, and this happens more than once, but the first time it happened was like we teared up. A gentleman came up to me. He had a veteran's hat on, and he says, "You know, I want you to know, in Nam, we had a little battery-operated tape recorder that had Red Rubber Ball on it, and I can't tell you how many battles that song got us through."
Wow.
So, and we hugged, we teared up and we hugged, you know.
That's pretty cool.
It's funny, we hugged. Yeah, we can't hug anymore now with this quarantine.
Well, you know, the song is one of those songs that did define the 60s.
It's
one
of, and so I have now recognized Red Rubber Ball has basically become, or has been, without me knowing it, an uplifting anthem of the 60s.
Yep.
And I'm so proud to have been a part of it and to realize that I had an effect on many, many thousands of people, most of whom I'll never meet, but some I now get to meet with the, you know, when we play and do the meet and greets.
Very cool. Very cool. I want to mention, you did a, you recorded a single, "I Did It For You," as a tribute to John Lennon, didn't you?
I did that with my ex-wife. And, you know, she just had this thing in her head, "Hey, let's do this," you know, and this was during my commercial recording years, and of course I had access to, we had our own studios, so, you know, so we did this, and yeah, we wrote it together, and we put it out.
Yeah.
Now we didn't have a big record company behind it, we just put it out on ourselves, and it did actually get some notice, but, you know, unless you have some, you know, entity behind it, and it was before the internet where things could all of a sudden take off on their own.
Yeah.
Nothing happened. But yeah, and I was proud to have done that. It was a good recording.
Yeah. You know, I'm also proud of you writing jingles. I think that's cool. There's a lot of legendary artists that did get into that I've talked to. What were some of the famous things that you did? I know Continental Airlines was one, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was one of our big ones. Another big one, "It's the next best thing to your good cooking. Swanson makes it good."
I remember that.
Man, for about 9 years or so.
Wow.
Let me think, another one. "All my men wear English leather, or they wear nothing at all." That was another one that I think maybe people would know. We did a lot of toys.
Yeah. Oh, gosh.
So we got a relationship with the agency that did Hasbro toys.
Right.
And we did a lot of that. And actually, the first big toy we did was Barbie doll, which was not Hasbro. It was another agency, and it was a campaign: "Surprising Barbie, Barbie, Barbie." We had a wonderful career, which I look back on really fondly. But the funny thing about and by the way, we do a little jingle bit in our show.
Oh, really?
Yeah, which people get a kick out of. Yeah, we play some of the commercials that we worked on.
Yeah.
And just to share, now, I didn't do this, but bandmate Tommy did it. And basically, I talk in the show, and I'll say, after we do, how did we get into jingles? And we both did it. We both had our own production companies. So we do a little medley of commercials that we had worked on. And then I'll say, "Well, you know, one of the things that was really cool for me is that, you know, agencies sometimes will have music houses do competitions.
Right.
Where they'll say, we want a jingle for a particular product.
Right.
And, you know, you write one, you write one, you write one. You know, people will write in. It's actually a competition. And the one that they like gets on the air and they get the job, basically. Well, we beat bandmate Tommy Dawes 3 years in a row for copper coat commercials. It was so cool to have done that. And then I'll do just a little bit of one of the ones that won and was on the air. It was like this. Flash 'em a dark tan, flash 'em a fast tan, flash 'em a copper tone tan,
oh, yeah.
Flash 'em a copper tone tan, bop. And then,
that.
You know, people will applaud.
Yeah.
And then I hang my head and I say, yeah, but in the end, Tommy had the last laugh.
Did he?
Because he went on and wrote the one commercial that there's not a soul in this audience that doesn't know.
Okay.
And then we all sing it a cappella, the band, we just sing it. Plop, plop,
oh,
fizz,
God.
Fizz, oh, what a relief it is. Plop, plop,
wow.
Fizz,
that's
oh,
huge.
What a relief it is. And then I look up to the ceiling and say, Tommy, you're in rock and roll heaven and you're probably
laughing
your fanny off right now.
Oh, my goodness. That is huge. Yeah, and you did you have a company called Mega Music? Was that you?
That was me.
Okay,
yes,
and you did some children's shows, scores for the shows, right?
We did a show called The Great Space Coaster.
Okay.
Which ran for some years, I think, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah,
and we were one of the regular music suppliers of that show.
Wow. That is so cool. I love that stuff.
Yeah. I mean, I guess it's always interesting. Where did people go? You know, where are they now?
Where are they now? Here's your final question. I know you got to go.
Yes.
If you had a Field of Dreams wish, like the movie, to perform, collaborate with anyone from the past or present, who would that be?
Oh, I think it might be Paul McCartney.
Paul McCartney.
I think it would be terrific to... To be able to do something with Paul McCartney would be really cool.
It's never too late.
I guess it's never too late.
Yeah.
You know, when the original Rondells,
uh-huh.
We got together for a 30th college reunion, and Tommy showed us he had received a fax from Paul McCartney saying, hey, it's so great to hear you guys actually are getting together again. You know, have a great performance.
Yeah.
So that was very, really cool.
That's cool. Awesome. I would just want to mention, everyone needs to buy the live CD, Full Circle, which is a celebration of the band coming together after so many years. And that's available on Amazon.com and probably on your website, I guess.
You can get it through that. And that was fun to do.
Yeah.
Just really quick, the origin of that mm-hmm. came from when we got back together, our bandmate, Pat McLaughlin,
right.
who is sort of the go-getter guy of the current band,
right.
he set up a video performance for us to do because we needed a promotion tape.
Mm-hmm.
And so we basically did, you know, we rehearsed, we did a whole concert. He had it recorded professionally. I actually mixed it. I mixed the audio myself. And that is available. And what came out of it was a short promotional tape of cutting, you know, just little bits and pieces of
right.
what we did.
Right.
And this was for agents to see that the band actually is a viable band.
Yep.
Because we hadn't been, there was no circle for 50 years.
Yeah.
And so, and I just want to say, it is really cool. I am now 76. I will be 77 in May of this year. And it is cool and an honor to be able to get on stage and play rock and roll at my age. It is just one of the greatest blessings that I've ever had.
Well,
life. And so for those who are Circle fans and come out to these concerts, thank you. And thank you for making Red Rubber Ball one of your favorites. It's very cool.
Well, you sound like you're 40, so...
Oh, well, thank you. Yeah, my voice kind of has held on there, yeah.
It sounds great. Nothing's changed. Don, thank you so much, man, for being on the show today. I really appreciate it. When we're back to normal again, I hope to see you maybe a few gigs in Florida. That'll be great.
Oh, well, we usually get down there.
Good.
You know, absolutely. So,
awesome.
Love to meet you, Ray. It'll be great to meet you.
That'll be wonderful. Thank you so much, Don. Take care,
right.
and the best
care,
to you,
Ray.
And your family. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now. Purchase the live CD now available. It's titled Full Circle. And it celebrates the band coming together again after so many years. And that is available at Amazon.com. And it's also available on iTunes and Spotify and other streaming sites. For more information about Don Daneman and The Circle, visit www.thecircle.com, www.facebook.com/The Circle. And The Circle are also on Twitter. Twitter.com/this_circle. Very special thanks to the dynamic duo of Doug and Don Newsome of VBS Radio for making the magic happen for each and every broadcast of Interviewing the Legends. If you have comments or suggestions for the show, contact me at interviewingthelegends@gmail.com. And please subscribe to my YouTube channel, Interviewing the Legends with Ray Shasho, for the very latest interviews. Hey, guys, it's real news. And, of course, my new book is finally out, entitled The Rockstar Chronicles, Series 1. I hope to do at least three more. Truths, confessions, and wisdom from the music legends that set us free. Order yours today on hardcover or ebook at bookbaby.com or amazon.com. It features over 45 intimate conversations with some of the greatest rock legends on the planet, and you will love it, I promise you. Stay safe. Have a great week, everybody.
Thank you, everybody, for listening to Interviewing the Legends, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Call 941-877-1552 or visit us at publicityworksagency.com, specializing in author and music artist publicity plans. We shine when we make you shine. Tune in to Interviewing the Legends every Tuesday at 7 p.m. Pacific Time on VBS Radio, Station 1.